You're listening to The Michael Shermer Show.
Before I introduce today's guest, I want to tell you about our one and only sponsor or advertiser. It's the GreatCoursesPlus.com app that you can get on your phone, and you can access there. It's a subscription model, so you can access thousands of courses and therefore tens of thousands of lectures, like one here on George Orwell that I listen to, in which then you scroll through and listen to whichever lectures you want, any or all of them. They go in sequence. You can just queue it up and start going, and it goes lecture after lecture. You can see the green ones that I listen to and the other ones I have yet to listen to. It's a great system because instead of buying an entire course, and then maybe you like some of it, maybe you don't like any of it, or just parts of it, and you want to skip on to the next course, you can do that with this app on your phone. So those who are listening to the podcast and access it through me, you get a $30 off for the annual plan, and you get a free trial, and it comes out to $10 a month. So that's like 2.5 venti lattes at Starbucks for infinite knowledge, accessible on your phone. It's a great deal. This is the sole sponsor of the podcast, other than the umbrella of the Skeptic Society that we're under. I'm not going to bring on here, my favorite pillow advertisers and guns and gold and whatever else supports podcasts. It's really the great courses, and I have them on because I use them all the time. I listen to these lectures, and content consumption is something we're all doing in the pandemic, and this is really the best source I've found. So give it a shot. Go to greatcoursesplus.com/Shermer. That's greatcoursesplus.com/Shermer. You get the $30 off and the free trial, $10 a month for the year. Great deal. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Dr. Kevin Dutton, and we discuss his new book, Black and White Thinking: The Burden of a Binary Brain in a Complex World. Kevin is a fellow of the British Psychological Society and a research psychologist at the University of Oxford. He regularly publishes in leading international scientific journals and speaks at conferences around the world. He's the author of Flipgnosis and The Wisdom of Psychopaths, for which he was awarded a Best American Science and Nature Writing Prize. His work has been translated into over 20 languages, and his writing and research have been featured in Scientific American, New Scientist, The Guardian, The Times, Psychology Today, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post, among other publications. So Kevin and I talk about, black and white thinking, from the world of physics, biology, psychology, politics, economics, society. It really comes down to what extent you put things into categories, because we absolutely have to do that just to even function or even think about things. And yet the problems that causes and where to draw the line in terms of those spectrums, and speaking of which, we discuss autism spectrum, but also all kinds of psychological categories, mental illness categories, and how many characteristics are in that category that somebody has to tick the boxes of before they are that diagnosis. But this is true across the board. So we talk about abortion issue and where you draw the line of when life begins. We talk about gender and sex, two sexes and two genders, as you all know, have been expanded to dozens or even hundreds of categories. Again, taking a binary system and making it more of a spectrum. When does a hill become a mountain? When does a heap of sand become a heap? How many grains does it take to become a heap? And one grain less is not a heap. And then we apply that to the difference between a cult and a religion. What is consciousness? That is, when do the lights come on? How many neurons does it take for consciousness to appear? We cover all that, and actually even more than that, end up talking about race and that very sensitive issue, and to what extent we can eliminate that kind of categorization of other people. So with that, I give you Dr. Kevin Dutton.
I'm
many characteristics of that are listed in the checklist of psychopathy do you have to tick before you're no longer a psychopath, or you are?
Do you know what, Mike? You actually took the words right out of my mouth, because I was going to bring psychopaths up right here. So seeing that you've done it, let's start with that. Because actually, when I wrote that book, The Wisdom of Psychopaths, back in 2012, that book caused a hell of a lot of trouble. It was very, very controversial, and it still remains to this day, I believe, the only book that argues that actually certain psychopathic characteristics can actually be beneficial to society. So I'll give you an example. Imagine if you've got the skill set to be a top surgeon, for instance, but you lack the ability to emotionally disengage from the person you're operating on. You're not going to cut it, are you, really? Well, literally. You know, imagine you've got the skill set to be a top lawyer, but you lack the ability to be the center of attention in the middle of a packed courtroom. Again, it's not going to work, is it? Imagine you've got the strategic and financial smarts to be a top business person, but that you lack the ruthlessness to fire someone if they're underperforming, or the coolness under pressure to ride out a storm, or the sheer balls necessary to take a calculated risk when appropriate. Again, you're not going to make it. So those characteristics that I've just outlined for you there, ruthlessness, fearlessness, self-confidence, coolness under pressure, emotional detachment, comprise five core characteristics of the psychopathic personality. Now, would you say they were dysfunctional in those particular contexts that I've mentioned? I certainly wouldn't.
No.
So that's what the Wisdom of Psychopaths was about. It wasn't saying psychopaths are brilliant, which is what the media, kind of some sections of the media portrayed it as. It was saying, listen, there are certain psychopathic characteristics which can benefit society. And, you know, so-called, you know, to simplify it, bad psychopaths use ruthlessness and fearlessness and low conscience and empathy for bad things, and good psychopaths are able to dial them up in the right context, like certain special forces soldiers, for instance, like top surgeons who I've done a lot of work with, like lawyers, people like that. So that was basically the synopsis of the book. Now, it was really interesting because, as you know, and I came over to visit in California, did a wonderful talk. Thank you so much for inviting me to do that. It was brilliant. Had a brilliant time. And that was pretty much just at the beginning of the trouble when it all got started. And it was after that that I sat and reflected in the aftermath. What is it about this book that really got people going? Why did people react so hotly to it? Why did it push so many buttons? Well, of course, you've got psychopaths. People, you know, always love psychopaths. They always have this kind of allure about them. People always want to talk about them and read about them and watch them on telly, all that kind of stuff. But it was more than that, Mike. It was something else. And so I sat down and I thought about it, and I thought, you know what? This is all about categories. And it's exactly what you were talking about with Trump, how actually he doesn't fit those stereotypical Republican kind of boxes. So, you know, people love to think of psychopaths as bad and the rest of us as good. But if you kind of mess around with those categories, if you kind of blur those boundaries and start saying, you know what, actually, there are some of us who are psychopathic who are pretty bad. And there are people who aren't psychopathic, you know, some of us are pretty bad. And there's actually people who are psychopathic who are pretty good. If you start fiddling around with those categories and blurring the boundaries between them, people really do not like it, because it goes against what I argue in the book is a categorization instinct. We are born with a categorization instinct, and we love to think of ourselves as good and psychopaths as bad. And if you mess around with people's categories, they really, really don't like it. And as I can attest from personal experience, they're going to come after you big time.
My favorite example from your book, or maybe it was your talk, is the Special Forces training program, where I think it was at the culmination of it, where they got the guy blindfolded and lying down on the pavement, and they fire up a big truck engine really close to him, and then they roll a tire right up to his head as if it's the truck, and if he doesn't flinch, he's a badass motherfucker, and that's who we want as a Special Forces. And I remember thinking, yeah, that's right, I want a badass psychopath out there doing the kind of the hard stuff no one else wants to do.
Absolutely. And you know, these guys, you know, as I say, they might not be they might not be the kind of guy that you'd want to go out and have a beer with necessarily on a Friday or Saturday night. Or some of them are actually very, very entertaining and very, very nice, warm guys. But I'll tell you something. If my other half was on an airliner taken over by Al-Qaeda, I know who I'd send in with the Heckler Koch right. MP5 submachine guns and the balaclavas and the respirators to get them out. So, you know, that's the key. So it's all about context. It's all about, you know, if you think about, you know, those characteristics that I've just outlined, ruthlessness, fearlessness, mental toughness, self-confidence, coolness under pressure, emotional detachment, those kinds of things as being the dials on a personality mixing desk that you can turn up and down in various combinations, you arrive at two conclusions. The first is that there is no one-size-fits-all objectively correct setting at which these dials may be positioned, but rather it will invariably depend on timing upon the particular set of circumstances that you might happen to find yourself in. And the second is that there exist certain professions that by their very nature are going to have some of these mixing desk dials turned up a little bit higher than average. Demand what I called in the book some precision engineered psychopathy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certain branches of the military, surgery, branches of the law, especially, you know, when you go into a courtroom and you argue cases, you know, certain professions are going to demand that some of those dials are going to be turned up. It's not black or white. It's not a case that psychopaths are bad and the rest of us are good. You know, ask any divorce lawyer that, you know, actually 99% of the pain that is meted out on fellow human beings is done by us. Right. And psychopaths do not have a monopoly on harm. You know, I'll give you a great example from the legal profession. You know, a top guy who I interviewed here a few years ago, one of our top attorneys, said something very interesting to me, which I've never forgotten. And he said to me, Kevin, information travels around the brain like electricity round a circuit. It takes the path of least resistance. Mm. So in other words, if you and I meet each other in a court of law and we're on opposite sides and I present the evidence of the case so that it travels around the minds of the jury in a more simpler fashion and in a quicker, taking a quicker route than your version of events, then I'm going to win the case. No matter whether I'm right or wrong, I'm going to win the case. And, you know, that when you think about it, that's a pretty psychopathic mentality.
Yeah.
But that's the use of psychology and argumentation to win court cases. So, you know, you might say, well, that's pretty remorseless. You might even say, well, that's immoral, but that's the nature of winning court cases.
Yeah, let's talk about the evolution of black and white thinking, which is where you start your book on kind of the physical world in which, let's say, you're a single cell amoeba floating around in the fluid, and you can go up or down, left or right, and, you know, backwards and forwards, and depending on where the light is or the food is or whatever. So so that's kind of where it begins. And from there, you kind of scale up to more complex nervous systems, but they're still having to make on or off decisions, which is a kind of black or white thinking. So take us through the evolution of black and white thinking.
Well, I think you're absolutely right there, Mike. And, you know, one of the examples which I often give is the British ethologist David Lack, who some of your listeners might have heard of. Back in the 1940s, the British ethologist David Lack conducted an in-depth study of the robin redbreast. And he discovered that once a robin had established its territory, the mere sight of an encroaching redbreast was enough to provoke a furious attack by the owner, the incumbent of that territory. Now, using models of robins, Lack was able to demonstrate just how important this red coloration is to robins, to the point where dummy robins with brown breasts were ignored, and clumps of red feathers tethered to I don't know, sticks and branches were actually attacked. Now, Lack's work has now become very famous. But actually, the kind of the cognitive implications, if you like, is that for this whole process to work, robins must possess an internal category for red, distinct not just from from very different colors like blue and green, for instance, but also from colors closer to it on the electromagnetic spectrum like orange. So, you know, when we talk about categories, we talk about, I argue in the book, for a lot of, you know, cognitive categories, but actually there are many, many precedents for this in the animal kingdom. And so, you know, when we get to the physical environment today, we have what I call evolution programs with a categorization instinct. Okay. So imagine if you went into a library, and you were trying to find a book. And you discovered that there was no classification system in operation in that library. Well, good luck with finding that book. You're never going to find it. If you've got a library of 100,000 books, you're going to be there forever. Imagine if you went into a shop to buy something, and basically there was no classification system in the shop. So groceries were in amongst haberdashery, were in amongst homeware. Everything was everywhere. Again, you'd never be able to shop efficiently. So on the back of like the biological categorization systems that we see in, you know, right across the animal kingdom, from robins and even single-celled amoeba, as you pointed out, right up to us human beings, we have a cognitive categorization instinct which enables us to simplify the world, to save time, and basically make it easier for us to do stuff. We need this, what I call, well, not what I call, but what Alfred Whitehead, the philosopher, calls a fallacy of misplaced concreteness. So the father of Western psychology, William James, famously said that when we come into the world, everything appears as a blooming, buzzing confusion. And in order to make sense of that blooming, buzzing confusion, we need to chop reality up into bite-sized pieces. So I say in the book that actually, you know, chess works because the board is black and white. Life works because our brains are black and white.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So in other words, you really couldn't even get out of bed and get out and go to work and lead a life if you weren't categorizing things. But the moment we start talking about categorization, then we shift to stereotyping, then we shift to prejudice, and there the kind of moral dimension comes into play, where it feels like it's turned into something dark. So, you know, race and yeah, gender, I mean, and these kinds of things that are hot button issues now, is that categorization thinking kind of gone to the dark side?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a great way of looking at that, Mike, I talk in the book about something that I call the viewfinder principle. Now, the viewfinder principle refers to our natural ability, most of the time anyway, to gauge the appropriate level of detail in which to evaluate and communicate information. OK, so just as a camera has landscape and portrait settings, when the viewfinder is either in or out respectively. So our brains have a kind of a cognitive viewfinder, which adjusts according to informational context and the particular demands of the situation we find ourselves in. So just as in an art gallery, for instance, you may want to view, I don't know, an impressionist painting from further away and say a Vermeer closer up. So in everyday life, there may be some types of information that we need to analyze and dissect in greater detail, to divide into many different categories and bisect with many different lines, and some types of information that is best processed in less detail in a more black and white fashion. So a good example might be the situation we find ourselves in over here in the UK at the moment because of the pandemic. We're now in another lockdown due to surging infection rates. And so the rule is, which comes from the government, no going out except for essential journeys. That is landscape, okay? Viewfinder firmly on big picture setting. It's a blanket aerial view, if you like. At other times during the pandemic, in previous times when infection rates, excuse me, weren't so high, we could afford to allow the viewfinder a little further in. We could meet three friends outdoors. We could non-essential shops were allowed to remain open. We were allowed to travel to certain foreign countries. Nowadays, we can't travel at all. All of a sudden, the picture takes on a few more details, a few more nuances. We're looking at it in a more portrait setting, as it were. Okay, so the viewfinder principle refers to this brain's natural ability to adjust according to the context we find ourselves in. Now, that's okay when we look at kind of information in terms of, you know, non-human factors, non-social factors. But if you start, using the landscape setting on people, that's when you get into stereotyping. If you're starting seeing, you know, I don't know, take example, all obese people or as lazy, all alcoholics as weak-willed, all Trump supporters as, you know, bigoted, misogynistic fascists, then all of a sudden you're veering into stereotyping. So landscape, in a sense, we're going back to the biological origins of categorization, landscape came before portrait. Imagine our prehistoric ancestors, you know, who were standing by a bush and suddenly that bush started to rustle. OK, there was no time for portrait thinking there. OK, you can't start sitting there thinking, is this a bear or might it just be the wind? OK, all rustles in bushes were stereotyped as bears and you got out of there fast, because if you didn't, you might well learn the hard way. So the landscape setting on the brain was the first one. And then later came the portrait setting. But these days, if we use landscape settings on people, that's what gives rise to stereotyping.
Yeah, I was thinking about this because California is in a shutdown again, too. And a lot of us are upset about the governor doing this because, like, I live in Santa Barbara, you know, the rates here are pretty low and pretty safe. So why do we have to shut down just because the county above us has a high rate, or the town that's in our county but still has a much higher rate? Well, if from his perspective, he can't really trust, you know, local, say, mayors or even owners of restaurants or whatever to know what the current spread rate of the COVID-19 pandemic is and so forth. So he's just got to have one blanket policy. And I was thinking about that, too, with, like, occasionally I'll go into a liquor store and I get or a bar and I get carded. Well, I'm 66 years old. I mean, come on. Well, maybe the owner feels like I can't trust the bartender or whoever, because what if it's not a 66-year-old? What if it's a 46-year-old or a 26-year-old and the drinking age is 21? You know, it's getting too close for me to trust the judgment call of the person making the sale. So they just have to have one blanket rule, card everybody no matter what.
Don't listen, Mike. Don't you tell me for 1 minute you weren't happy to be carded at the age of 66, okay? I don't listen. Don't you even try to convince me of that. That okay, made your day, mate, didn't it? But actually, yeah, you're absolutely right. And you think you're bad in California. Okay, let me give you a situation that occurred over here in the UK not so long ago. It was before Christmas. And so before the blanket lockdown that we had now, before that kind of landscape setting, we had a more portrait setting in which the country was divided up into different tiers. There were four tiers, and the tiers basically referred to how much social interaction inhabitants of that particular tier could have with each other. So in areas of very high infection, which was tier four, they couldn't go out at all. In areas that were very low infection, people could carry on pretty much as normal, but there weren't many of those areas. Now, these tiers were set along county lines, okay? So they were already, broadly speaking, pretty well delineated on the basis of existing geography within the UK. But a very strange incident occurred. Now, I know to your American listeners, this probably won't make much sense, but there is two bordering counties, which are Kent and East Sussex in the south of England. And it just so happens that actually a village straddles the border between these two counties. So the county line goes right through the middle of the village. Now, one of these villages was in a low tier area. One of these counties, rather, was in a low tier area, and one of them was in a high tier area. Now, you can kind of predict where this is going, can't you? There were two pubs which were separated literally by 300 meters, but two village pubs in the same village. But one of the pubs was in the high tier county and one of the pubs was in a low tier county, which meant that one of the pubs could open for Christmas and one of the pubs had to remain closed. Now, of course, Christmas being a very, very busy time for pubs. They make a lot of revenue, a lot of income. This was a major deal.
Yeah.
On the one hand, it seemed grossly unfair because it's the same village pub. You know, it's a pub in the same village, but actually you're in a different county. What to do? Well, they had to abide by the black and white law, which was drawn along the line of the county. Although you're a pub in the same village, I'm afraid we're going by county rules here, and one has to remain closed and the other one is able to open. Now, it gets even more bizarre than that because there was also someone in the north of England whose house and garden fell into different tiers. I'm not making this up. This is absolutely true. So the line was kind of basically went. It was the old county border followed an ancient culvert which went under the ground between their house and their garden. So, you know, actually what they could do in their house, they couldn't do in their garden and vice versa. So these lines, when we draw lines, sometimes we draw lines to aid our survival. We draw lines, as in the COVID examples I've just given you, we draw lines to stay alive. Sometimes we draw lines to simplify the world. But, you know, there are times when we draw lines and we basically just have to suck it up. You know, it's going to make us on one level look a little bit silly. But that's the nature of line drawing. You know, a great example that I use is if you're driving in a 30 mile an hour speed limit zone, and let's say you get done by the police, you get pulled over, flagged up, and you get a fine for doing 31 miles an hour. Okay, so you might feel you've been very, very hard done by. Why didn't you let us go to 32 or 33? So okay, let's say you get a bit of a leeway, and we'll let you go at 33. So you just shunt the problem further down the road, literally further down the road, because then if you get someone who's done at 34, they're going to say, well, hang on a minute, he got away with it at 33. So you've got to draw the line somewhere. So sometimes, Mike, black and white thinking is essential. A lot of times, as I said, we've covered it with stereotyping, it can get us into trouble. But there are times when it's essential. And in the early days of the pandemic here in the UK, and this mantra has now come back, the government had a very, very clear, concise and powerful communication strategy. And that was stay at home, protect lives, save the NHS. And that was stay at home, save lives, protect the NHS. And that was, there was no room for maneuver in that mantra. Everybody knew what it meant. It's come back now, and everybody is observing that, broadly speaking. That is a great example of how black and white thinking is very useful and can come in handy.
Yeah, on the speeding category, I figured out where I live, speed limit 65 on the freeway. You get up to 75. I figured out that if I keep it under 80, that is, if the radar gun of the cop has a 7 in front of it, he's probably not going to ticket me. But the moment you're over with the 8, so that 8 seems to be the trigger point where that's now in a new category. but let me go to...
You know what, Mike?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was just saying, Mike, you know, you're probably a marked man now when you get on the freeway. they're going to be looking up you. They're going to say, okay, well, all right, that's him. We'll show him. But actually, technically speaking, you've got a 10% leeway. So here in the UK.
Transition between categorization, stereotyping, and then prejudice. I think it has to do with the emotional salience of the word you're using. The simple example being that you discussed that film, The Englishman Who Went Up a Hill and Came Down a Mountain. The definition of a mountain is, X meters high, and the hill is, was however many centimeters below that. So they hauled up some dirt to make it a mountain. But why is a mountain better than a hill? Why do they want a mountain? And I was thinking, is it because mountain has more gravitas to it? Like, we live near a mountain, whereas a hill seems kind of, I don't know, wimpy or small or doesn't have as much gravitas.
I think you're absolutely right. I think language is a very, very powerful motivator. And, you know, so many things are kind of hooked up in the language we speak and in the labels that we use. I'll give you a great example, which comes to mind, which I use in the book on that. And it involves the film director Danny Boyle and the London Olympics, which happened back in 2012. Now, 62,000 people, I think it was, Mike, attended the dress rehearsal of those Olympics. But it was remarkable that hardly anyone leaked the contents of that dress rehearsal on social media. Now, that is amazing, given all the various ways in which they might have done that. Now, no one can say definitively why that was, but word has it that Danny Boyle, who was the director of the opening ceremony, stood up at that dress rehearsal and asked everyone present, all those 62,000 people, not to keep it a secret, but rather to save the surprise. Now, a lot of people might read that and think, well, that's just a trivial, insignificant detail, right? Maybe. Could it possibly, though, be persuasion genius? Well, I'm personally give Danny Boyle the benefit of the doubt here, because it serves my purposes, of course. But actually, if you think about the difference between keep it a secret and save the surprise, it seems infinitesimal. But just let's just consider that, keep it a secret. Actually, yeah, we all kind of know deep down that, you know, it's good to keep a secret. But if we're being realistic about it, actually, we love sharing secrets, don't we? We love just confiding in a trusted other and saying, hey, you know, seeing that it's you, I'm going to tell you this, but keep it to yourself. That's a great way of spreading rumors, by the way. However, no one likes to spoil a surprise, do they? That's very different. So by using the language, using that terminology, save the surprise, as opposed to keep it a secret, I think Danny Boyle pulled an absolute masterstroke there. I think he knew exactly what he was doing, and that is why the contents of that dress rehearsal never got out. And that's a great example of how our choice of language really has an impact on our behavior and the behavior of others.
Yeah, so here I think that simple example then ratchets up to something like we have different categories of black and white, say, of skin color and races. And even though there's many, many shades of gray in between, because the words become so loaded historically with prejudice and all the discrimination that we've experienced, those words then do matter. And then the shades of gray start being put into those categories. So, for example, you know, Obama famously had a white mother, and Kamala Harris has an Asian mother, and yet they're still, you know, just considered black because they now have positions of power and prestige and respect, and we're trying to sort of correct for the past. And what we're really doing is saying black is not bad; it's good. Look, it's respectable. It's, you know, they have positions of power now. We don't have to live under that shadow of our history anymore.
I think you're absolutely right. And you know what, Mike? I think that social media, I've thought a lot about this. I think that so it's easier to point the finger at social media, isn't it? But I do think that social media is responsible for a lot of this. I think at no time in our history has our sense of identity, of who we are personally, been so dependent on what we say or believe or are seen to say or believe. I think that's the crucial point right there. So when we argue or make a point, we think to coin a phrase like lawyers rather than scientists. So rather than trying to get to the truth, what we try to do instead is we try to win the argument. And this is why it gets very emotive when you start thinking or using terms like black and white and Republican or Democrat, truth or falsehood. Compromise or backing down, rather than being seen as a virtue, is seen very much as a retreat from this highly prized, high premium certainty of black and white into weak, indecisive gray. And I think that's what's probably going on here. You know, I once heard an amazing statistic that the brains of modern day Western city dwellers like us take in as much information during the course of our 24-hour period, as the brains of those who lived in rural medieval Britain would have taken in during the course of an entire lifetime. Mm-hmm. Now, that's really quite scary and totally believable when you look at what's happening on social media. And I think what social media does, I'm not demonizing social media, by the way, Mike. I mean, there's plenty, it does plenty of good stuff. But there's a number of things it does which are very interesting. It introduces us to millions of people like ourselves, but it also introduces us to millions of people who are not like ourselves. Now, we have a need to define ourselves optimally, our individual sense of selves against the backdrop of the collective. There's an optimal point at which, according to the social psychologist Marilyn Brewer, at which this kind of point exists. And given the fact that, you know, social media, as I say, introduces us to millions of people like us and millions of people not like us, we're competing for these scarce social resources. Everyone is clamoring for attention. I think what we get is an identity war. I think this is a perfect storm for an identity war. And with that, you get all the attendant stuff like cancel culture, you get othering, you get trolling, you get fake news, because this is all about people arguing like lawyers and not like scientists.
Yeah. Well, in the category of biology, still continuing, you would think sex would be pretty black and white and maybe gender slightly fuzzier. But the last couple of years, as we've seen and you discuss in the book, Facebook now has, I don't know, however many dozens or hundreds of different genders that you could be. And so just to kind of, how do you think about what's happened the last couple of years with that? It can no longer just say it's simple male or female. There are people that now identify as the other sex. And then the gender, you know, makes it even more culturally fluid. And then there's also a distinction between what I identify as, me as a person, male or female, and then who am I'm attracted to, male or female, or, you know, trans or whatever. And that seems to get ever more fluid. So that seemingly relatively biological black and white categorization is now super fuzzy. To what extent do you think some of this is kind of politically motivated because we want to work past those prejudices against gays and the LGBTQ community, and also the oppression of women over the centuries? We want to correct for that. How do you think about all that?
Yeah, I think there is a degree in which what you're saying there is true, Mike. I think there is a political agenda in some of it. What I call it is category creep. So it's really interesting that, you know, I think the categorization instinct evolved originally to help us simplify the world, to save time, for it to make it easier for us to do stuff. And I think that actually what's happening now, and again, it goes back to the viewfinder principle of what I was talking about earlier. I think that there may well be a number of different motivations to twist that viewfinder in or out and knock it off what might be an optimal setting. And I think what we are seeing in certain situations is that in the social environment, I think identity is kind of hijacking the need for functionality. I think there's a personal agenda sometimes that is hijacking public interest. And I think we need to be very, very careful of that, because if we don't have a functional society, identity won't mean anything anyway. So we've got to keep that balance between functionality and identity. And there was a great example of this, which I mention in the book, which occurred, I think it was last year, where an airline was criticized by a passenger for being transphobic because they were classifying perfumes in the duty-free trolley, which came down the aisle, using the labels ladies and gentlemen. Now, you know, that's a very interesting argument because, you know, the fact that, you know, perfumes are are categorized using those labels, ladies and gentlemen, is very much a time-saving device. There's no political statement in that. That's a time-saving device. So, you know, if you want to buy a perfume on a flight and you say, well, I'd like, I don't know, perfume X, instantly the cabin crew can go to the appropriate section. Well, that's a male perfume or that's a female perfume. So you are cutting down the search time by 50%. It's efficient. So the labels, ladies and gentlemen, is for perfumes is very much a functional categorization. But actually, if you get rid of that functional categorization and you use a categorization system based on identity or personal agenda, all of a sudden you've made the search task way more complicated. You've actually doubled the time it takes for the cabin crew to find that perfume, all things being equal. And so that's where I think we've got to be very, very careful. I think, you know, I've got nothing, you know, no argument against, you know, having as many categories as you want, so long as it doesn't infringe on functionality. And the original reason why the categorization instinct evolved, and that is to simplify the world, to save time, and to make it easier to do stuff.
Do you have an opinion on the trans male to female competing in women's divisions in sports?
Yeah, I do. I mean, personally speaking, I'm a sports person myself, not a professional one. I like running, always have done. And I believe, I'm not sure if this is true, I believe that the Boston Marathon a couple of years ago, had actually allowed men who identify as women to compete in the women's race. Now, I believe that's true. I think that's true. Forgive me if it's not, but I wouldn't have come up with that out of nothing. But if that is the case, I think what you're, I mean, that is grossly unfair, I think, to women. I think what that leaves open is a huge door to abuse of that particular policy. And so, you know, you might well get, you know, being cynical about it, this is just common sense, Michael, you know, you may well get male athletes who are, you know, never going to win the male event, who are going to, you know, fast enough to win the women's event. So I think, again, the gender labels male and female are there for a reason. And they're there for a reason because it makes it simple. Now, there is always going to, you know, simplicity is always going to have casualties. But I think, again, it's important to get this sense of balance. You know, actually, that's very unfair, I would argue, on women. And I believe that a number of female athletes have actually argued that point, themselves. So I do have a view on it. And I think I personally don't think that's a road we should go down. But that's my personal
opinion. Yeah, I agree with that. And it seems to turn on to what extent, in that example, the transitioning from male to female, if you start taking the hormone treatments, does it weaken you enough that you're now the equivalent of a female body? And I think there's not enough evidence to draw that conclusion one way or the other yet, because it's still so new. But the problem is that there's so many different factors going on at the same time. It's not just muscle mass. It's also, you know, bone mass and strength and, you know, and all other, a bunch of other factors going on there, variables at work. But that's the argument that, you know, if they transition biologically.
Do you know, I think one of the stories which speaks to that, Mike, is the story which first inspired me to write Black and White Thinking. You know, and I was talking to you earlier about, you know, it was the aftermath of the Wisdom of Psychopaths book that, you know, got me thinking about why that book was so controversial and you mess with people's categories. But on top of that, there was a story which I heard which really got me thinking, actually, there might be something in this book and this idea. And as I say, it's directly relevant to what you were just saying there about lots of different things going on. And it involves the renegotiation of a border between two countries. And 100 or so years ago, not sure exactly where it, when it was, Russia and Finland were renegotiating the border between the two countries. And it just so happened, this border, to go right through the middle of a Finnish farmer's farm, an elderly Finnish farmer's farm. When I say right through the middle, I mean literally right through the middle. His barn was in Finland and his cow shed was in Russia. Anyway, one day a delegation of Russian officials turn up on his door and they say to him, listen, you need to make a decision. You need to decide which side of the border do you want to live on. Do you want to live in Finland or do you want to live in Russia? Because here in Russia, we've got a census coming up and we need to know who is eligible. Now, this puts the farmer in a really tricky position because Russia has actually been pretty good to him over the years. They've given him help on the land. They've given him free running water. They've given him subsidies, et cetera, et cetera. But of course, he's Finnish and, you know, he wants to be loyal to Finland. Anyway, after a few moments thought, the farmer comes to a decision, right? And he says, look, he says, I'm immensely grateful for the support that Russia has given me over the years. She's helped me through some very tough times. However, on reflection and with the greatest of regrets, I'd like to see out my days in Finland. You see, I'm an old man now and couldn't take the, and can't take the cold like I used to. And another Russian winter might kill me. Okay, now that is a funny, cute story. But actually, Mike, it contains profound wisdom. And that is that we think in exactly the same way that light travels. We think in fast, straight lines. Now, if you think about all the different things that exist around a geographical border, national identity, political unity, sovereignty, all those kinds of things. And yet, at the end of the day, it just comes down to a single line dividing those two countries. And, you know, as I say, our brains have evolved this categorization for good reason, to simplify the world, save time, make it easy for ourselves to do stuff. But we cannot get over this binary instinct that we have to draw very simple lines between things. And that's the point that I first got when I heard that story. I thought, yeah, you know, our brains think very much like light travels in fast, straight lines. And we just can't get over that. We can't we can't stop that. Evolution is one of the things we know about natural selection. It's a bit of a hoarder. It likes to hold on to things that are useful, even if many years later we sometimes deploy them in ways that are not useful.
Yeah, like the difference between scientific and legal thinking in the abortion issue. You know, scientists say, well, there's no place perfectly to draw the line. It depends on, you know, this week or that week, what argument you're making, that the, you know, neural network comes online, or, you know, the awareness and feeling of sensing of pain, maybe the viability outside the mother's body. You know, it depends on which argument you're making. But legally, politically, we have to draw the line somewhere. We have to have a law, and it says before this, it's illegal. After that, it's legal. And, you know, I'm pro-choice on the abortion issue, for mainly for historical reasons having to do with women's autonomy and control of their bodies and so on, and how that's unfolded over the centuries. But I have to say, after listening to your section on that, you know, if you have to draw the line somewhere where a quantitative difference all of a sudden makes a qualitative difference, the pro-life argument that it begins at conception, life begins at conception, seems to be a stronger place to draw the line than any of the other, say, neural network type arguments, or, you know, 20 weeks, 22 weeks, or 24 weeks. How do you think about that issue?
Yeah, I think it's, well, this touches on something which I mentioned in the book called the Sorites principle. Now, some of your listeners may know what the Sorites principle is, and some may need a bit of an explanation. The Sorites principle was invented, I suppose you could say, by a rather obscure Greek philosopher called Eubulides. And I'll do my best to explain it because it is a little bit complicated. So you'll need to pay attention here, folks. But the Sorites principle broadly goes as follows. So one grain of sand is not a heap of sand. Okay. Now, by the way, I should say Sorites is the ancient Greek for heap. Okay. That's why it's called the Sorites paradox. So one grain of sand is not a heap of sand, which is pretty obvious, right? A single grain of sand is by definition not a heap of sand. Now, hopefully, something that also makes sense is that by adding a single grain of sand to something that is not a heap of sand will not turn it into a heap, okay? It's silly to think that a single grain of sand would make the crucial difference between something that is not a heap and something that is a heap, right? Which means that we've got a bit of a problem on our hands here, because from these two premises, the logical conclusion is that no matter how much sand we add, we will never make a non-heap into a heap. Now, of course, we know in real life, so to speak, Mike, that heaps of sand exist, right? We know that. We've seen them. So the question is, and this is right at the heart of the Sorites paradox and at the heart of the question you asked, is if you start off with a single grain of sand and systematically add individual grains to it one by one, you will eventually end up with a heap of sand. But at what precise point in the process does the single grain of sand that is not a heap become a heap?
Mm-hmm.
After, you know, I don't know, 9,999,999 grams, when the 10 millionth grain is added? Clearly not, because we know that the addition of a single grain of sand, we've already established, cannot turn a non-heap into a heap. And so the Sorites paradox, for goodness sake, don't ask me to explain it to you, okay? Don't ask me to solve it, rather. I mean, people have been trying to solve this for centuries. But actually, you know, you may say, well, that's quite a, you know, a kind of a quaint philosophical paradox, a thought experiment, but how does that translate into real life? Well, it translates in exactly the way that you've said it does. You know, there are legal lines that we draw for when a fetus can be terminated. Now, you know, let's say, you know, if you draw any line in time, you could argue, well, okay, you could have two women sitting next to each other. And if that fetus is, you know, if you want to be really, if you want to reduce it to the absurd, you could say if the fetus in the belly of one woman is 5 minutes older than the fetus of the belly in another woman, then actually, you know, that's one woman can have a termination by law and one can't. So as soon as you start drawing a line, as soon as you have a temporal line, you have that situation where actually, you know, a quantitative difference makes a qualitative difference, as you say, and you have to live with those consequences. The abortion debate is a very serious one, but we can see it in all kinds of ways. We can see it in, you know, we've all been there. We've all put on weight gradually, you know, under our very noses. When all of a sudden you look in the mirror one day and you think, blimey, how did I get to this? You see it with when you look at, you know, clocks. If you look at a very good clock or watch, you don't notice the minute hand moving. But actually, if you come back 5 minutes later, all of a sudden you notice that difference in time. When do you become old? You know, the difference between young, middle age and old. Again, you know, is it a matter of numbers? Is it how you feel? There was a guy on a fantastic case, I think, occurred in the Netherlands last year, where a guy argued that actually, if you're able to change your gender, you should be able to change your biological age. Right. Because he got assessed and they said that his biological age, he was in his, I think, late 60s, and doctors had said, well, your biological age is actually more like late 40s. So he said his actual motivation for doing that was he would have more success with the chicks on Tinder, which was, again, you might say, an extreme case of personal agenda hijacking functionality. But he said, well, look, if you can change your gender, then why can't you change your age? If I am biologically 49, I might in kind of real terms be 69, but actually, if I'm biological 49, isn't that a good reason to change my age on the basis that people are legally entitled to change their sex? Actually, that case was ruled against it because I would imagine that it would, you know, there are so many ramifications and implications of that, that again, society would start breaking down if we could all pick and choose what age we were.
Yeah, there was a case like that here last year with, you know, gender fluidity, and you can, you know, identify as whatever gender you want. How about race? And there was that case of Rachel Dolenos, who was a white woman who identified as a black woman, and she was even head of the local NAACP, I think, in Seattle. Yeah, but that was not acceptable. That was considered very controversial because race is somehow different than gender in terms of those categories. I guess the emotional salience or moral salience we put to it.
Well, there was an extreme case which I heard about. I think it was in the UK, Mike, where a woman prisoner. Was actually housed with a male prisoner. This is in a female prison. And the male prisoner identified as a woman. And the male prisoner who was identified as a woman was put in the same cell as the female, the biologically female prisoner. Despite the biologically female prisoner protesting at this, because it turned out that the prisoner who was male, who identified as female, had been convicted of rape. And lo and behold, he ended up raping his female cellmate or her female cellmate or whatever we want to call that. So that's an extreme case, again, you know, happens where, you know, arguably identity, political agenda, personal agenda start hijacking functionality. I think, you know, at the bottom line of all this, we need to hang on to the reason why natural selection programmed us with a categorization instinct. And that was to simplify the world and to make it easier for us to do stuff. And I think if we start tinkering with that, we're going to be causing problems. We're going to be asking for trouble.
Yeah. A couple other things that I thought of reading your book on what is a species? You know, so the famous definition by Ernst Mayr is a species is a group of actually or potentially interbreeding natural populations reproductively isolated from other such populations. And he claimed that Papua New Guineans, I think it was Papua New Guineans, identified bird species the same way Western biologists identified them. So he was arguing that These are real categories in nature. And yet then I'm reminded of one of Richard Dawkins' famous lines, my favorite lines of his, is that no Homo erectus mother ever gave birth to a Homo sapiens child. That, you know, these are somewhat arbitrary categories that we put on species. But in fact, they're quite blended over long periods of time. So it's kind of a temporary stopping of time, or, you know, kind of defining the category at this moment. The cat can't interbreed with the dog, say, so we call them different species. But over the long run, you know, this could, it's much more fluid.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great example again of the sorites paradox. It's like, you know, actually, you know, there are infinitesimal degrees between different members of a species, different species. And, you know, I think Richard also makes the point about salamanders, doesn't he? Californian salamanders, and how it looks actually on, he did a study or somebody did a study when they looked at these different salamanders, and actually it looked like there were seven or eight different species. But actually, that's because you don't see the species that might have been linking those independent species. And actually, if you reveal the whole picture, actually everything is on a seamless continuum rather than these kind of discrete dichotomous species.
Yeah, those are
species.
Called ring of races, in which
– That ring of races.
I think it was wasn't salamanders. It was lizard. These California Ensitensis lizard.
That's the one.
Yeah, so this population that overlaps with that population, they can interbreed, and this one can interbreed with that one all the way down the, I think it was the ridge of the Sierra Nevada mountains. But if you took the northern population and put them with the southern population separated by hundreds of miles, they couldn't interbreed. So at some point, you know, with all those interbreeding populations, not technically different species, just different subpopulations or subspecies, but at some point they're different species because they can interbreed if we use that definition.
Exactly right. That's it. And it's exactly coming back to the sorites principle and taking example of time, you know, and applying that to species. What that's like, it's like if you look at a clock at, say, 10:05, and then you go away for 5 minutes, you come back, you will see it at 10:10. You will notice a big difference. It's a quantitative difference. But if you sat down in front of that clock and stared at that hand moving in real time, you wouldn't see it get there. You wouldn't see it get from the 5 to the 10, from the 5 to the 10.
Right.
And so that's exactly it's literally a direct reflection of that.
I was also thinking about this in the context of what's the difference between a cult and a religion, and maybe put a sect in between the two of those. And again, it just depends on how you're defining these things. So like I had in White People Believe Weird Things, I had a list of cult characteristics: veneration of the leader, inerrancy of the leader, omniscience of the leader, persuasive techniques, hidden agendas, deceit, financial or sexual exploitation, belief in absolute truth and absolute morality, and so on. Yet you could find several of those characteristics.
That sounds like the Catholic Church.
Yes, I know, exactly. But, you know, so how many of those do you have to tick off where you're no longer a religion and now you're a cult? Well, that depends on how we define these things.
And yeah, absolutely, Mike. And also who's defining them as well. So that's the other interesting thing. So, you know, actually you've got almost like a hall of mirrors effect here. So, you know, you can come up with a load of boxes to tick that differentiates a cult from a religion or a sect from a cult. In exactly the same way, you know, the massive problem in my field of psychology, especially clinical psychology at the moment, with, you know, actually do discrete mental disorders, psychiatric conditions even exist? I mean, the whole argument around classification of mental disorders is exactly what you're talking about there. And actually there's, you know, a growing body of thought now. Which is actually, you know, everything is linked and everything's on a continuum. And, you know, some criteria that you might need to fulfill for one condition might also tick the boxes for another condition. So you can't really draw the line between the two. And then, of course, that's got implications for treatment as well. And again, it comes right the way back to psychopaths. You know, this whole idea of you're either a psychopath or you're not. Well, actually, you know, one of the things I did in Wisdom of Psychopaths was to say, well, actually, you know what? Just like we've got an autistic spectrum and spectrum disorders, which vary along the autistic dimension, there's a psychopathic dimension as well. And we're all on it. There's a psychopathic spectrum. But I think, yeah, I mean, the other question, which in that hall of mirrors effect, which leads on from that is, well, yeah, okay, if you're drawing up a list of criteria and you've got 10 criteria to fulfill for any label, for any categorization, for any diagnosis, who's drawing up those criteria? Who's to say that they're the right people, the right authorities, the right bodies to draw up that criteria? So, again, you're pushing the problem a little bit further down the road. And, you know, again, it's all to do. You can start saying, well, you know, some people have more of an agenda than others to include these criteria over those criteria and vice versa. So you get into a real quagmire.
I think that's why sociologists of religion quit using the word cult. And now they call them new religious movements, NRMs, because it doesn't have that pejorative sense to it, and I can kind of see that. But again, at some point, if you know there's massive exploitation, sexual and financial or even physical abuse exploitation that goes on, it doesn't feel like it's just a new religious movement. It feels like it's a dangerous cult, and then the word carries more gravitas to it.
I've got a better classification for you. How about criminal organization? There you go.
Yeah, that's okay. Right.
How about a good old stereotyping there, Mike, that we were talking about earlier? Criminal syndicates. How about that there? Yeah.
Well, that's why, you know, again, liberals describe the Trump family as, you know, like a criminal organization or as grifters, you know, because it carries that emotional salience to it. I remember meeting Temple Grandin at one of the TED conferences where she gave a talk, and, you know, she had her several published books, you know, professionally published books. And I was thinking, you know, this woman is autistic. And then I started thinking, I see why she's so popular, because the word autism carries a certain kind of categorization on the sort of low end of in the intelligence scale, say. And here's this woman that earned a PhD and she's, you know, articulate and interesting and smart and on and on. And I think the reason people like to hold her up is to say, look, the word autism doesn't mean what you think it means. Okay, you know, I like that. That's good. But then what does it even mean to have a expression, the autism spectrum, that's so broad, it can encompass pretty much almost everybody.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think, again, it comes back to language, and it comes back to the way our brains are wired, Mike. So, you know, over evolutionary time, our brains have learned to take shortcuts, right? To use mental rules of thumb to make decisions, to use learned associations, to assimilate millions upon millions of bytes of previously stored information to generate response outcomes. Now, to use a home improvement analogy, this wiring that we have, that our brains have, can either be put in by reputable tradespeople. In other words, on the basis of reliable information, for instance, you know, scorpions are very likely to sting you, so don't pick one up. Or the wiring can be put in by cowboy traders. In other words, on the basis of unreliable information. For instance, you know, you hear it a lot and you get black people are more violent, are less intelligent, engage in more criminal activity, all this kind of stuff that certain sections of the media come up with. Now, this isn't to say that the wiring itself is a bad thing, because we need this wiring in there to help us make quick decisions in everyday life. As I think the writer Kurt Vonnegut once pointed out, life happens far too quickly for us to be able to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But we need the wiring there. But, you know, in fact, just like electricity in the home, it's essential. But what we need to be careful of is that if this wiring is put in by rogue traders, for instance, by erroneous information, it can be dangerous and sometimes downright deadly. And that's when you get into stereotyping, whether it's on the basis of race, whether it's on the basis of psychological conditions, whether it's on the basis of politics and religion. It's all about that wiring that's been put in into the brain. Well, or rather, who's put it in? Has it been put in by reputable tradespeople? Is it there on the basis of reliable information, or has it been put in by rogue traders? And actually, it's been instantiated on the basis of unreliable information.
Yeah, I was thinking about the heat problem, too, with the problem of consciousness. You know, when do the lights come on is usually the question that's asked, implying that there's a light switch. But of course, it's not a light switch; it's a dimmer. But here you're going from categories to almost an infinite number of shades, depending on how many species we want to count that have brains. And you just kind of scale down all the way to, I know, single cell organisms are not conscious unless you define consciousness as what it's like to be something. And I presume the amoeba knows what it feels like to be something. My dog is conscious, but not as conscious as, say, a chimp or a gorilla, and maybe they're not as conscious as a human, you know. And there we're just, again, scaling down from it's just a level of complexity to simplicity. Where do you draw that line? How do you think about consciousness in that context?
Well, I mean, I think it's absolutely true. I mean, I was interviewing an amoeba the other day, Mike. And
and he told you what it was like?
And it said, hey, we're conscious down here in this pond. We've got consciousness. It's only a little bit different to yours. But yeah, absolutely right. I think, you know, again, I'm no consciousness expert, but it seems to me that, again, you know, it's an application of sororities. You know, dog owners will say that, you know, I've got friends who are dog owners that argue that, you know, their dogs are conscious in a way that matters to them. You know, they know what they're thinking and all these kinds of things. And, you know, and then you've got situations where you've got clinical symptoms like, say, locked-in syndrome, for instance, where, you know, people can only communicate with, you know, an eye movement or something like this. So there's variations of consciousness within humans, but then there's variations of consciousness across different species as well, going right the way down to that amygdala, that amygdala, that's part of the brain, that amoeba that I was talking to the other week. So yeah, absolutely. It's I don't, you know, where do you draw the line? I think, you know, arguments can be made all over the place. I'm interested in where you draw the line in evolution. I think that's very interesting, especially from a religious point of view. I've always had this debate with people with religious beliefs that say, you know, that you know, if there's an afterlife and we're all going to be saved and just, you know, all this kind of thing. Well, okay, so we're talking about human beings here, but at what point in our evolutionary history do you kind of, you know, pull the ladder up and say, well, okay, you know, we're all right, we're going to be going to heaven or wherever it is, but actually, maybe Homo habilis won't be. Or, you know, in the, you know, if we scroll forward another 10 million years, if the Earth keeps going for that long, we might be a completely different kind of species. So where does that leave us now in terms of salvation or damnation in a religious context? So I'm fascinated with that kind of thing as well. I think that's a very interesting argument.
Yeah, you had that quote from Nina Simone about the difference between a voice and a piano. But really, it's just the number of steps in between. Let's say a piano had 500 keys, it would be more like a voice, or 1,000 keys or something like that. And it's just kind of a matter of scaling up. Then that made me think of my friend Nick, who's really into vinyl records. He has a huge collection of vinyl records. And he thinks that analog records, you know, vinyl, is better than DVDs, which are, you know, digital. And it's like, well, what do you mean by better? Well, richer, there's more steps in between or something like that. But, you know, if you look at a vinyl record under a microscope, it's just a whole bunch of little jagged peaks and valleys that the needle is bouncing over. And that's still kind of digital. It's just that there's so many steps in between, the two categories. It's all analog or digital, depending on how you define those. Or am I wrong there? What do you think about that?
Well, I'm no music expert, Mike, but I've got to ask you, does your friend have a big hipster beard, wear a check shirt, and eat muesli and drink organic coffee?
No, actually, he's not into any of that. That's the funny thing. But it could be that I think people that like vinyl, they like the kind of the hiss and the pops and the sounds that digital recordings weed all those out. They filter all that stuff out. I think maybe some people like the richness of analog and all that background noise enriches the recording.
Yeah, and I think also when you start talking about music as well, Mike, I think it's not just about the music that you hear. It's also about the emotional associations that it has for you. I know some people who prefer vinyl. I mean, I grew up with vinyl. Some people prefer vinyl because it takes them back to formative, you know, times in their life when actually they first heard those songs that they so dearly love, even now. And then, of course, vinyl has made a comeback in recent years. And then you've got the kind of the in-group identity that it then becomes, you know, actually there's a, you know, if my friends are into vinyl, it's kind of cool. Then, yeah, actually, maybe there might be something in it. So, again, it might be a kind of almost like an icon, a symbol around which you can identify, a totem. So I think it's very complicated. But in terms of the sound, whether there's a sound difference, I really am not the right person to ask about that. I'm musically tone deaf, actually, Mike. But I think there's, when you talk about music, there's certainly a lot. There's a lot of complicating factors in there to do with emotion, to do with as I say, formative times in your life, the connections that you make between, you know, past experience and memories and the tunes and the music that you like. And also, as I say, I made a joke about hipsters and vinyl and coffee and beards and muesli, but actually, yeah, there's a kind of an identity around that as well. So that might have something to do with it for some people too. And then, of course, you've got the purist that might say, well, actually, vinyl is just better.
All right, let's talk about another hot button issue, income inequality. We mentioned it earlier. How much is too much? Here I think of my friend John Mackey, who is the CEO of Whole Foods, a big supermarket chain here in the United States. And he has what he calls conscious capitalism. He feels that, you know, a CEO that makes, you know, 1,000 times more or 500 times more than the average worker is just too much. So he set in his company 19 times. The CEO should not make more than 19 times the average worker's salary. And, you know, again, that's that the heat problem. Where do you draw the line? Well, he just say, okay, I'm just going to draw the line here, 19 times. That's it. And but as a psychologist, you know, I don't know how you think about these things, but why, you know, why at some point it feels like that is too much, you know, 500 times the average worker, or, you know, that Elon Musk is worth this amount or Jeff Bezos is worth that amount. That just feels like it's too much. But yet very few people would object to, say, the local, restaurateur, making, you know, X amount of more than I do. Well, he took the risk to open that restaurant, and okay, that seems okay. There's a lot of subjectivity in there, and yet, you know, we have a sense that, you know, above this line, I'm not feeling good about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. And I mean, people are going to have, I mean, it would be, you know what, it would be a great experiment to do, to find out whether how much people earn, whether their incomes actually moderate the place at which they draw that line. I think that would be a really interesting study for someone to do. I would imagine it would, actually. I think that, you know, the restaurant owner down the road who's worked hard, who's taken those risks to open that restaurant, et cetera, et cetera. I think in terms of identity, you're far more likely, the everyday man or woman is far more likely to identify with them than they are with a mega, mega, uber rich multi-billionaire. Who, by the way, you know, I know a couple of billionaires. They haven't given me a cent, by the way. But I know a couple of billionaires who actually started off from scratch. They started off penniless. Mm-hmm. And they took a lot of great risks in starting up their businesses. And they lost a lot of money. And it certainly wasn't a smooth trajectory from, you know, nothing to billions. And so in a sense, it's almost like you could turn around and you could say, well, hey, would you rather I was less successful? You know, would that make you feel a bit better if I was worth, you know, maybe 400 billion rather than 500 or something like 400 million rather than 500? So I think I think one of the factors here might be, again, comes back to identity, how much we identify with people. And I think if you yourself are in a very, very high income bracket, then actually it may work exponentially, Mike. And you might find that actually, you know, the line that person would draw, if you were worth, say, 100 million, you certainly wouldn't think, I would imagine, that someone worth 500 million, that, you know, that was, you know, too extortionate. But if you were worth, you know, if you were just an everyday working person, then yeah, I think you would set the ceiling far lower. And as I say, I think when you talk about restaurant owners and people who are like us, as it were, yeah, you can appreciate the risk because it's scalable. You can appreciate the risks that they've taken because you can identify with it to a greater extent. When you're talking about billionaires, you can't appreciate those risks to the same extent. But actually, if you scroll back in time and, you know, if you were to look at, well, what they were like when they first started out, again, I suppose if you're like humanizing them in a way, because maybe there's an argument to say that actually, you know, when we look at people like Jeff Bezos and your Elon Musks and all that, we kind of, in a sense, dehumanize them. And I think, you know, if we saw these people more as, you know, well, there was once upon a time when, you know, they were pretty much like us, we might, you know, reconsider where those lines were drawn.
Yeah, there's also, I think, a survivorship bias, or I think it's called a survivor bias, where we see the people that made all the money and were successful. What we don't see are the people that tried and failed. So, you know, as I like to say, criticizing all these business books, you know, these are the 7 habits of highly effective people and all that kind of thing. Or Steve Jobs died and Walter Isaacson's biography became a massive bestseller. As people kind of scrolled through to figure out what made this guy successful. You know, so here's the perfect model. You go to a highly rated liberal arts college, then you drop out. And you move back to your parents' house and you start a startup in the garage with your buddy. And then you treat people like a real asshole. He's probably something of a psychopath himself. And that's the key to success. It's like, yeah, that worked that one time. But how come no one writes biographies about the people that dropped out of college, moved back to their parents' house in the 70s and started something up with their buddy in the garage. And they failed because that's what most of them do. It's like 99% of entrepreneurs fail in their first time out. And you know, we don't hear about those. And so the way it works here, if you are successful, you know, you pay your capital gains tax, say 15% on your investments. And if you fail, you lose money on an investment. Let's say you put a ton of money into some startup that your friend is doing and he goes bankrupt and you lose your money, you can deduct that over the course of many years on your taxes. Although you don't get your money back completely, but at least, you know, it softens the blow. So we've kind of drawn lines just to say, okay, it's 15%. That's what you're going to pay on, say, stock market investments when you sell the stock, something like that. And the difference between liberals and conservatives now is, where do you draw that line? So, you know, during Roosevelt's time, I think the highest tax bracket was like 79%. Now it's 39%. And so all this political debate is just, well, where do you draw the line? You know, and conservatives now, you know, want to lower it a little bit, maybe, you know, to 29% or 35%. And liberals want to bring it back up to maybe 49%. And so, you know, this kind of the rich are rich and whatever depends very much on just where that line is drawn.
Well, and it comes back, Mike, to what we were talking about in terms of, you know, psychological conditions and criteria drawn. And you were talking also about, you know, differences between religions, cults and sex. And we kind of made the point, didn't we, that it, you know, OK, criteria is one thing, but whose hand is on the pen that's drawing the line? Who is responsible for coming up with those criteria? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And is that in a sense is the real problem underlying this? And you put your finger on it right there when you were saying, actually, you know, you get Republicans, you get Democrats, and actually simply on the basis of political affiliation and political view, they're going to have a different point of drawing the line. That is certainly not unbiased. That's being influenced by political affiliation and persuasion. And, you know, we were talking about the study I suggested earlier, where if you look at maybe income level, I'm sure that will have an impact on where you draw the line between, you know, who's earning too much and who isn't. So I think, you know, at the bottom of this line drawing issue is not just where we're drawing the line, but who is drawing the line. And then who determines who's drawing that line? You know, so who's determining who's the line drawers? It goes on and on. And we have a real kind of hall of mirrors situation there, I think.
Yeah. Well, we've been going almost an hour and a half, Kevin, but I don't want to leave before we talk about race, because I think that's not going to go away anytime soon, even if Brexit and Trump and all that goes away or settles down. You know, there's something about race that's just it's just really so dominant in our culture that we just can't seem to shake it in terms of these kinds of categories. You have a discussion in your book about these studies that show how people, both blacks and whites, look at pictures of a black or white person with a tool or a gun, particularly when the information is slightly degraded and you can't quite make it out. You know, then that's, I think, where you were talking about our categories that we have in our minds fill in those, that degraded information based on our current prejudices. And yet I know those early studies of the implicit association test have been criticized and not always replicated, or it may be that it's true. These things are going on in our heads. We associate blacks with more negative stereotypes and so forth. And yet people do they act on those or not? So kind of give us your what you think the latest science is on prejudice, particularly racial prejudice, and what in the world we can do about that.
Well, I think, you know, it comes, we touched on this earlier, Mike, and I'm really glad you brought this up, because I think whenever you start talking about race and prejudice and that kind of thing, I mean, stereotyping, you know, as I say, is really interesting with stereotyping, because stereotyping often gets a really bad rap. OK, but actually, you know, stereotyping, I just want to get this in before we kind of finish. Stereotyping also helps keep us alive. So, you know, here's a simple example. If you're walking down, you know, a dark city street at night in a strange city, and all of a sudden, you know, four guys with hoodies suddenly kind of start walking behind you, I don't think it's unreasonable to maybe think about crossing the road, okay? However, if you were walking down that same city street at night and all of a sudden four women in business attire started following you, you probably wouldn't think so quickly about crossing the road. Now, that there is stereotyping in action, okay? So, you know, stereotyping, you know, can sometimes keep us alive. Stereotyping, don't get me wrong, is sometimes be very, very bad. We've talked about that. It can be deadly and it can be pernicious. But, you know, stereotyping, you know, quick decision making, heuristics, that kind of, you know, all goes back to the rustle in the bushes. You know, is it a bear or is it a wind? Well, let's not, you know, stand here too long trying to think about it. Let's get out fast and kind of have a look from a distance and check it out, what it is. So, you know, this idea of reaching quick decisions based on minimal information evolved for a reason. Now, I think if we then go back to the analogy that I used about, you know, hardwiring in the brain, but, you know, the home improvement analogy, and, you know, it's not the wiring itself that's bad. It's not the fact that we make quick decisions on minimal information that's bad, because we need to do that. We need to be able to make quick decisions. If we had to weigh every new situation up from scratch, you know, assembling all the myriad bits of information that come into our brains to reach a decision and a judgment call, we wouldn't get anywhere. So what's important is not the wiring, but how the wiring has been put in. And that's where I think that's where the answer is. I think, you know, to use that home improvement analogy again, wiring can be put in by, you know, very dodgy people. It can, you know, if you start looking at various sections of the media and you start believing the agendas that they're pushing, and, you know, that kind of information starts taking hold, then the wiring in your brain is being put in by what you might call, you know, dodgy tradespeople, disreputable tradesmen. But if you kind of, you know, evaluate information, critically think about it, you know, consider both sides of arguments and, you know, spend some time evaluating evidence, that's when information starts being put in. That's when the wiring starts being put in by reputable tradespeople, in a sense. And that's when you start to get a balanced view of things. And I think that actually what those studies show there, which I was talking about, is that, you know, yeah, these when you have to make split seconds decisions about, you know, which faces are threatening and which aren't. Yeah, studies have shown that actually when white people look at a computer screen and they see a black face with something in there, a figure with something in their hand. Yeah, I mean, actually, studies show that white people are more likely to interpret the ambiguity of what that person is holding in their hand. It could be a phone or a gun. They're more likely to interpret it as being threatening, as being a gun. But actually, what's really worrying too, Mike, is that actually that bias, that cognitive bias, isn't just present in white people. It's also present in black people against themselves. So that's really interesting, you know. So, you know, actually you get this kind of this pernicious media, this pernicious information which comes out of some quarters, that, you know, black people are somehow stereotyped as being more violent and all this kind of stuff. And actually has an effect on black people as well as white people. And that's why it's so regrettable and it's so dangerous. And it, as I say, it's going back to the home improvement analogy. It's not the wiring that's the problem. It's who's putting the wiring in. What can we do about it? Well, it's a great question. And I mean, you know, I think the absolute number one priority is that we educate ourselves. And that's, you know, it's fantastic to be invited onto your podcast, because that's really what this last hour and a half has been all about. It's been about raising these issues of black and white thinking, about categorization instinct, what's good about categories, what's bad about categories and that instinct. And I think this is a great way forward. It's about raising awareness. It's about educating ourselves that, you know, we've got a bit of a problem here. You know, very simple kinds of, you know, examples such as phasing out discriminatory employment practices, for instance. You know, there was a wonderful study I heard last year that orchestras that that had blind auditions to become members of that orchestra were something like 46% more likely to hire female musicians. Okay. Which is, that's really, really interesting. So, you know, we might want to start thinking about, you know, discriminatory employment practices and how we can reverse them. I think also what we can do, and we've touched upon this earlier as well, is we can tackle generalized assumptions by being clear that a particular attribute or trait or characteristic is associated with an individual and not necessarily with their group as a whole. So, you know, I think the example I used with, we're more likely to see, you know, or we see people who are obese as lazy, or alcoholics as weak-willed, or stuff like that. Actually, that may be the case in a handful of individual cases, but, you know, certainly not in the case of everybody. You know, these, in some cases, people have underlying medical issues. There is a whole raft of factors which underpin those conditions. And, you know, findings that have come out of social psychology for years, any social psychologist will tell you, it's social psychology 101. We see members of outgroups as all the same. We tarnish them with the same brush. And that comes back to our point about stereotyping, whereas we see members of our in-group as being much more heterogeneous. There's much more variety among people in our in-group. Yeah, you know, we're all eclectic. And this is a real in-group, out-group bias. So we need to be aware of that as well and tackle these generalized assumptions about people that we don't know. And again, you know, we can look to, you know, when I talk about educating ourselves and raising our levels of awareness, a great example, let's go to the clinical psychology literature. You know, if you've got arachnophobia, if you've got a fear of spiders, it's a well-trodden path how you get rid of that fear. And what you do, you start learning more about spiders. You look at pictures of them. You read about them. And then gradually over time, through repeated exposure, starting off with looking at pictures of spiders and then maybe a real spider at a distance and then bringing it slightly closer and closer and closer until in the end you touch it and then you can pick it up, you're able to get over your fear of spiders. And I think, you know, there are direct parallels with this, and the kinds of people that we hang out with, our social circles, people who we choose to be friends with. You know, the more diverse your circle of friends, the less of a fear reaction that you're going to have in your brain, and studies have borne this out, when you encounter an out-group member. So, you know, there's empirical evidence that actually, you know, just by broadening our circle, literally broadening our minds and opening our social circles and meeting people from a wide variety of backgrounds, what social psychologists call the contact hypothesis, and it's been around for a few years now, actually, that is a great way of reducing fear and suspicion, and also prejudice and stereotyping. And, you know, thinking of ourselves as you know, as being, you know, all part of the same group, as it were. I mean, you know, I think Joe Biden, when he in his presidential and in his inaugural acceptance speech, said, you know, he's not a president of division. He sees Americans rather than Republicans and Democrats. And I think, you know, looking at people in a superordinate goal, using superordinate categories to define groups is also very important, I think, and a real antidote to the prejudice and discrimination that we see so prominently in our society today.
Yeah, what worries me about identity politics is this constant emphasis talking about race and looking at race and thinking about race, and, you know, everything is race in America. It's just a constant part of our conversation. I understand why we do that. You know, if I was a black person and I walked into a store and the employee started following me around thinking I was going to shoplift, yeah, I wouldn't like that. That would not be cool. And, you know, we stop doing that. We got to do something about that so people quit doing that. But this kind of let's talk about race and tick the boxes of race, and we got to keep track of what race everybody is on all the different, you know, government forms and applications to universities and so on. It seems like, you know, this superordinate goal of let's just look at everybody as individuals instead of their race. And yet, you know, we constantly talk about it and as if that's the most important thing I can know about you is that you're this particular race. That seems to be in conflict.
Well, absolutely. And I think, yeah, I mean, that comes exactly back to what we first started talking about, Mike. It comes back to what setting we have the viewfinder on in our brains. Do we have it on landscape or do we have it on portrait? And there are some times when actually it's good to have it on landscape and see things, take a more distant view of things, take a more aerial view of things, take a more general view of things. And sometimes it's good to have it on portrait and to actually, you know, zone in on the details. You know, I'll give you a great example of this, a kind of a less serious example, but, it, you know, it, rather than race. And I tell this story in the book. I always remember a few years ago, I went into a DIY shop not long after I first got to Oxford, actually. And I went in with my wife and we wanted to buy some blue paint that the shop had. It featured it on a bathroom wall in one of their flyers or one of their brochures, I think. I'll never forget it. I went down to this shop and I said to one of the assistants there, have you got any of this? And I showed him the flyer and he said, well, I'm not sure. I'll have to check the system or whatever. And I couldn't believe it, Mike. I mean, you know, there were pots of blue paint all over the store. So I distinctly remember it. I said, look, are you telling me that you don't have any blue paint in this store? You know, I thought it was a wind-up. And he looked at me and he said, listen, he said, I've been in the paint business for 30 years. And when you've been in the paint game that long, blue means absolutely nothing. I haven't seen blue since the late 80s or something like that. I've seen Aegean and he reeled them off. He said, I've seen Aegean Odyssey. I've seen Celestial Haze. I've seen Cerulean Rhapsody, but blue, afraid not. And what you're looking at here, and he pointed at the flyer, what you're looking at here is Velvet Breeze, mate.
And, Velvet Breeze.
Yeah, it's a funny story, but it's absolutely true. And every time I step into my Lapis Rockpool shower, I think of that guy in that store that time. And it's a very good example, I think, of what's more serious when you're touching on issues like race. And I'm not being flippant about that. But it's a very good example of what we've touched upon a number of times during this discussion. And that is optimal categorization. And optimal categorization is very dependent on context and how arguably the environment that you inhabit, that you find yourself in, can determine, you know, how you define and categorize that environment and also how we communicate with each other. Here's another example. I mean, imagine I was giving you something. Imagine if I was giving you directions, okay, something very simple. And I said, Mike, I want you to turn right at the end of the road by a square concrete structure with a door, four windows and a driveway that's got a mammal which barks, has four legs, fur and a wagging tail in the garden. OK,
yeah.
You would think I was a bit strange. OK, wouldn't you? Why didn't I just tell you to turn left at the house with a dog? Right. Because it's simple, isn't it? As soon as I say those two words, house and dog, your brain fills in all the details automatically. On the other hand, Mike, imagine I said to you, okay, I want you to take a right at the vermiculated artisan's dwelling with a mansard roof and a Bergamasco shepherd in front of it. Again, you'd think I was nuts. Now, instead of being overly general, I'm now being overly specific. Unless you're an architect who also, you know, liked, you know, rare dogs, you wouldn't have a clue what I was on about. In fact, you probably wouldn't have a clue what I was on about anyway. So instead, we go for a happy medium. And that is what I think, that's what black and white thinking is all about. That's what this book is all about. It's saying, you know, we're born with a categorization instinct. Sometimes we over categorize, sometimes we under categorize. Both gets us into trouble. we need to find a kind of a happy medium. And you know what, if you would ask me to explain what, you know, in a very short space of time, if I had, you know, a minute to explain what it was about, that's what it's about. It's, I start the book with a quote by a British musician who your listeners might know, Noel Gallagher, who was one half of the British rock band Oasis that were very big here in the 90s. Noel and Liam Gallagher were the two joint frontmen, I guess you could say. Noel was the guitarist and Liam was the vocalist. And they had a rather incendiary relationship, let's put it that way. Basically, they hated each other for a lot of the time. And Noel has this great quote, and he describes his brother Liam as a man with a fork in a world of soup.
I know.
Which is
so
it's one of my favorite quotes of all time. And basically, that's black and white thinking in the space of a few words. And so the point of black and white thinking in the book, I argue, hopefully convincingly, that actually Liam is not alone. And that we all have forks in a world of soup. And as the kind of the author of the book, I guess, I'm kind of like the waiter in the corner of the restaurant, trying to catch your eye with a tray of spoons and saying, hey, this is a better implement to use. So you know, it's all about finding that happy medium. It was great. I was on holiday a few years ago and in Australia, actually. And this kind of sums it up. I saw a purse which was lying on the road and had been discarded or lost or something like that. And I did check, Mike, to see if there was any money in it. There wasn't.
of course
so
you did.
It was really funny. What was more I know. But what was more important to me was I'll never forget it. There was this slogan on the front of the purse. And it said, life is simple and we insist on making it complicated. And I was walking along and I thought about that. And I thought, you know what? That couldn't be more wrong, because actually it's the other way around. Life is complicated, but we insist on trying to make it simple. And by trying to make it simple, we make it far more complicated than it actually is. And that's the bottom line of black and white thinking.
That's perfectly put. That's a great place to end it there. I did want to ask you, though, just give us your thoughts, how optimistic you are about the future. Let's take it out far, like a century from now or 500 years from now. Will we no longer see race? It just won't even be visible to us anymore. Or in the case of Brexit, you know, we'll no longer see people as German or French or English, but, you know, just this kind of fluid, you know, economically porous and politically porous borders and so on. They'll just be people. Or is that
too
unrealistic?
Do you know what, Mike? I know what you're getting at, and I'm going to be totally honest with you. Yeah, of course, you know, there are a lot of downsides in seeing people as, you know, us and them. You know, we have this us and them instinct in us. Which, you know, evolved 5 or 6 million years ago when our prehistoric ancestors were living in small groups. And we developed this us them kind of bias and mentality. And it would be lovely, on the one hand, to think that, you know, actually we will no longer see race. We will no longer see rich and poor. We will no longer categorize as people into Germans, French, Americans and all that kind of stuff. And of course, you know, with a lot of the evils going on in the world at the moment, it's very tempting to say that would be a good thing. And on one level, it would. But, you know, if you no longer see people as us and them, you're giving up a hell of a lot. You're no longer going to have the Super Bowl, for instance, because, you know, two competing fans, groups of fans, two competing teams, well, you're not going to see them.
Right.
You know, you're not going to have great types of music like rock and roll or jazz or blues, because actually, you know, if we lose that ability to draw lines and to parse differences, we're going to lose very much the essence of what it means to be human. So I think the bottom line is, mate, we've got to take the rough with the smooth. We've got to keep drawing the lines, but we've got to keep learning from those lines so we draw better ones and more nuanced ones and more informed ones as we go on into the future. But I certainly wouldn't want to lose the FA Cup final over here, the big soccer cup. And I'm sure that you guys wouldn't want to lose the Super Bowl. So be careful what you wish for.
My wife's from Germany, and she got the biggest kick out of the baseball World Series, world champions. It's like,
oh, yeah.
How many teams are from Europe? None. We have one from Canada. That's about it. So much.
And I think Cuba, isn't it? Cuba are quite big. Is it Cuba? Are they quite big, I think? Or
well, they're big in baseball, but they're not part of the World Series teams. Yes, in baseball. Well, Kevin, thank you for writing this book, and especially for your work in general. I think this is, you know, really super important. What's next on the
Well, you know, funnily enough, Mike, I may well be heading back to Psychopaths. So it's been 10 years since The Wisdom of Psychopaths came out. And actually, there's a book about the book now, because I've had so many adventures and things, had so many experiences on the back of writing that book. I think maybe I might start thinking about writing Wisdom of Psychopaths 2, which will be a bit more of an entertaining book than the Wisdom of Psychopaths was like the science behind the new theory. I think a lot of people would now. I think a lot of people might give me the credit for kind of winning the argument. And you know, nowadays, if I do media on psychopaths, people in the old days, it used to be, you know, surely this can't be right. You know, you can't, psychopathic characteristic can't be good. Nowadays, it's like, well, that's kind of accepted, but I've got to give examples. And so it's kind of got a little bit boring, in a sense, because I rather like the, I liked a bit of heat and, you know, so, but
you,
I think
you,
what's
you
next
set
is,
up, training
I think
programs
another book for, on psych.
You should set up training programs for major corporations, like how to train your employees to be good, positive psychopaths.
Well, do you know what, Mike, you may jest, but actually I wrote a book.
I know you did.
With the Good Psychopath's Guide to Success.
Yeah.
With a British special forces guy, and it became very popular. But again, that started the fires again, because everyone started saying, "Well, Dutton's trying to turn the world into psychopaths," which I wasn't, of course. But
that's funny.
But it was just getting people to turn the dials up on those mixing desk dials. But yeah, I think next is may well be another book on psychopaths, I think. And I just can't get away from them, Mike.
That sounds good. Yeah, well, we'll have you back on when that book comes out. Kevin, thanks so much for coming on. It was a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Well, Mike, it's an absolute pleasure to talk to you. It always is. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
In the post-COVID world, I'll come visit you in Oxford.
Well, that would be lovely. It would be really great to have you here. We can go out for a pint. We can have afternoon tea. We can do all those traditional British things that none of us Brits have been doing for a year.
That's right.
So it'd be great to revisit them with you, sir.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.